Great. Okay, let's get started, Greg.
Okay. Welcome to Dev B212. If this isn't the one that you wanted to be in, maybe you can go find the one that you need to be in. So what we want to do is talk about what this talk is going to be about, because your time is valuable, and if this isn't what you expect, we want you to know. What this talk is about is not so much about the tooling, but it's more of a talk about people and processes, and it's really a talk about our journey as our organization when moving from an organization that shipped a box product every 2 years to an organization that ships every 3 weeks to a hosted service, and what that meant to us as an organization internally. These are the five points, talking points that we're going to be going through. And you're going to be hearing a lot of war stories and things that we didn't do so well. We're going to be kind of honest with you of what we did and what we didn't do. So that's what the talk is. If you are interested in talks about the tooling, these are the talks that you might also want to look at as well, where we dig a little bit deeper on each, on quality, on agile tooling, source control, and also taking ALM to the cloud. All these are getting a little bit deeper in the tooling as well, so those talks are available for you as well. All right? So let's get started. First, I thought we'd like to know who the people are on stage. So this is me. My name is Greg. I'm a farm boy. I grew up on a farm. I learned how to drive a tractor when I was 5 years old and so forth, so that's my heritage. I am, this past January, I celebrated my 25th anniversary to my wife. And we have 3 boys. And I tell people, you know, don't let the nice smiling face of my wife fool you. She's a very, very tough woman when it comes to those boys. She doesn't let them get away with anything. We added a girl to the mix. My oldest son got married a while ago. And so now we have a girl, and my wife's very excited about that. Lots of times people ask, hey, do you have hobbies? And I don't have many, but I've picked up one lately, in that I brew my own beer. So it's something that I like to try. Does anyone else here brew their own beer? Do we have any home brewers? Okay. A couple. Okay, that's good. So that's something that I picked up recently to do. I've been in software for 26 years. I'm happy to be in it. It's a very fun place to be. And 8 of those years I've been at Microsoft. And I love Agile. I'm a big believer in it, and I'm excited to tell some of the stories we're going to tell today.
Okay, so this is me, Martin Woodward, martinwoo@microsoft.com if you need to get a hold of me, or if you want to abuse me on Twitter, there you go, that's how you can do that. And if you get really excited by all the Team Foundation Server and Visual Studio stuff you've been listening to this week and seeing at the foundational session this morning with Brian Keller and over at the keynote, then I encourage you to subscribe to radiotfs.com. It's a podcast that we do on the, all the really nerdy details of Team Foundation Server. But as Greg said, we're going to talk about the people side today. Oh, and one other thing as well. If you want to know more detail about the products and stuff, just a quick plug for the book. So there you go. Helped write a couple of books. Not that that makes me an expert. It just means I've got some friends that are experts, and I know who to ask, so you can get those at the store. There we go. Brian. Okay. I live over here in Northern Ireland is where I'm from. That's where I live and work, in my house, in the middle of the beautiful countryside of rural Northern Ireland. And I'm a product owner on my team. My official title inside Microsoft, same as Greg, is a program manager, which is ironic because I don't program anymore. I don't know if you do, Greg. No, neither of us program. And in fact, neither me nor Greg actually manage any people. I don't have any people who report to me. So it's a strange title to give me, really, program manager. I think actually sometimes I wonder what I do, and mostly it seems like we delete email. But what we tend to do is we act as the product owners of our program. We make sure our program is being managed, and the part of Visual Studio or Team Foundation Server that we look after is on track to deliver. And we're the little, like a little captain of our little ship on the journey to delivery. So I live here, I work remote. Most of my team, most of my developers and testers and people, they live in North Carolina. The Team Foundation Server team that me and Greg are on, 50% of the team are based in North Carolina, apart from the odd strange person like me in Ireland. And then the other half of the team are over there where Greg lives, over in Redmond, Washington. So the whole team is spread out across the world. We've got people in China. We've got parts of extended team in India. We've got people spread all around the continental United States as well. And so managing those distributed agile teams as well has been a challenge that we've had to address. So, Greg.
So, like I said, let's get on with the talk. This is a story about our journey from point A to point B for us. So let's talk about what point A is. Point A is we used to be an organization that shipped a box product about every 2 to 3 years. That's what we did. And the last of those was the 2012 release, 2010, 2012, 2 years. Now we've gone to an organization that ships to the hosted service every 3 weeks. So we ship production quality software to the hosted service every 3 weeks. We ship an update to the previous boxed product about every 3 months. So you've probably seen update 1, update 2, update 3. And we're working on our next release of the boxed product, which will, since it's labeled 2013, roughly about a year after the first one. So our world has changed a lot. And that's what we're going to talk about. What does it mean? What did it mean to us to be changed here? So one big change, is this working now? Is the length of our sprints, our iterations. In the 2008 release, our sprints were 10 to 14 weeks, around 3 months long. And then in 2010, we got them down to about 6 weeks. And in 2012, we finally standardized that we were all going to be on 3-week sprints. And eventually, in 2012 timeframe as well, we started shipping. After every single sprint, we were shipping to the hosted service. So I think one of the things that it's kind of a key indicator of how well you're doing as far as agile things is how short you can get your iteration as an organization.
And how we did this was quite interesting, because I was talking to a PhD student a few weeks ago, and we were talking about how Microsoft works. And he was saying, so who's in the program office? You know, who's in your project office sort of thing? Well, we don't really have one. How do you decide what to do? Well, you know, does anyone tell you what to do? Well, no, not really. It was a shift from a command control structure where we were told very much, you know, these are the ideas. They went up to the executive level. They then got reviewed and signed off. And then we delivered to pillars, and we all delivered this work. And that was how it was all done before. This is what we're going to work on for the next 2 years. Sometimes it slips to 3 years, you know. But this is what we're going to do. And now it's about creating an environment in which everybody can work. And actually, everybody can be in their individual teams steering towards a common goal. So rather than having everybody controlled from the top down, it's very much individual, self-controlled teams, empowered teams that can deliver their area of the backlog. The interesting thing you have from the management point of view is then making sure you herd all those sheep, you steer all those boats in the right direction so that it goes the right way. So now as a senior manager, rather than trying to turn a big ship, actually what you're trying to do is get a flotilla of small ships to go in a different direction when you need to adjust course. So it's interesting, different challenges, but that's kind of what we've done there.
Yeah, I think another thing to add is that we're not saying that we gave up control, right? There is, like, you need both control and you need to empower your teams. But we found is that some of the command and control things that we relied on when it was this one big ship on a 2-month cycle, we couldn't rely on it. It didn't scale when you had lots and lots of little boats going out and doing it. And that's something that we realized when we were doing it.
And we also became more honest with ourselves that the command control structure, it wasn't really working anyway. Mm-mm. Everyone kind of does their own thing anyway and just pays lip service to managers. So a lot of it was about embracing actually, this is how we are developing anyway, so let's model our delivery process around how people really work, not how we tell our managers that we work. Mm-hmm. So the key question is to really think about your own organization and think about how you empower your teams and how you delegate work down to them. Do you trust them to do the right thing? Or do you force them to work on certain things? And do you encourage them to take initiative and to change, to react to changing environment and actually change what they're working on, you know, in an agile way, rather than working on what you told them to work on because it should be the right thing. Okay. One of the important, so agile, you know, capital A agile, has a lot of best practices and things that people talk about. One of the ones that we did a lot of is retrospectives. For those who don't know, as I say, this is the definition of a retrospective is at a regular interval, so whatever makes sense for you and your team, usually it's at a sprint boundary, an iteration boundary, you sit back and you reflect on what you've done, and then you look at how you can become more effective next time round, how you can learn. And that we found that to be a key principle for us. And just your behavior, there we go. And these were the three questions that we really like to ask ourselves. It's what do we do well, what could we do better next time, and how do we improve? And the key in the retrospective is for it to be a safe environment, mm-hmm. for it to be, you know, not a place of retribution and things. And sometimes during a retrospective, it can be quite uncomfortable. You know, oftentimes it's, hey, you know, I'm responsible for making sure people get mock-ups in time and making sure teams are talking to each other. And sometimes it'll be, hey, we didn't know about this early enough. We need to know about this sort of thing sooner. You know, why were we surprised by this? What can we do again? And quite often, you know, you think to yourself, actually, I could have personally done something myself to make this better. But there's no blame. There's no placing a blame on people. And the whole point is to try and everybody on the team kind of feels a little bit guilty and thinks, how can I improve the team in mm-hmm. the long run?
Yeah, I think the safety thing is an important thing. We had a situation where a manager would sit in on the retrospectives because they wanted to see what was going on. And it completely changed the tone of the meeting, as you might guess, right? Now, this person wasn't there to cause any blame or cause any problems. They were just curious, but we had to ask that person not to be there. And because it has to be safe, I would say it has to be safe in all situations. If you have an organization where devs rule the world and testers are sort of second class and testers don't feel safe to share, that has to be fixed. That's what we found, is it has to be safe for everyone to share. Now, how many of you do retrospectives today? So quite a few people. Okay, now keep your hands up. Now, keep your hands up if you think you're seeing significant change as a result of those retrospectives. Okay, so quite a few people kept them up. That's great. Thank you. We found a technique that seems to work for teams that are really successful at it. They do something like this. They all are in a room. The retrospective is pretty quick. And they just go around the room, and everyone says what they think went well and what didn't go well. And then they just quickly go around the room, and then they might go around the room again until everyone said their piece. And then they'll say, okay, based on what you see on the board, are there any things we want to specifically do different in the next sprint based on that? And people will throw up ideas of what we can do different. And then we say, does anyone want to own this to make sure it happens? And only the ones that get owners, actually we say we're going to do. So if not, someone doesn't want to sign up to own it, then it wasn't that important. It sort of sifts out the chaff, if you will, and gets you the things that people really are passionate about. And then some teams do this. They create a user story that shows at the top of the task board called retrospective action items, and they have tasks for each one of those. So every stand-up, they're being asked, is there progress on improving this kind of thing, just as a way to bring visibility to it. Because often, I don't know about you, I kind of forget what was said in the retrospective after we're all done, you know. So that's a way of making it visible.
Just on that, one of the things that, because I work in a remote team, when we do our retrospectives, we're all spread across the globe. And so we do it over a conference call as part of the sprint planning. We do a retrospective. And I write up as people are talking. It's being projected into the room where some of them are, but it's also being projected into Link where everybody else is. And I write up as people are talking, saying what their points are. We write them down we actually do it into Excel. And then when it comes to what, you know, what do we need to do better, how do we improve, write those up. And then as it comes to who's going to own this improvement, who's going to do something next sprint to make this better, to change the process, we'll actually, if we need to, put a work item onto the backlog right there and then using web access in TFS, you know, and just add it straight in so we don't forget about it. Because if I leave things on pieces of paper, I just forget because I'm useless at that sort of thing. So
we'd always did retrospectives, even when our sprints were like 3 months long.
We did them when we were 2 years long.
We did. I remember a two-day retrospective at the end of 2005. And what happened in those retrospectives of long periods of time is that we would have this great discussion. We'd have post-it notes and pieces of paper all over the board and people voting what they want to do next. And then at the end of the meeting, we'd roll up those pieces of paper. Someone would bring it back to their desk, put it on their desk, and then pretty soon they would put it under their desk. And then pretty soon it would just be kind of on the side underneath some other stuff, and nothing ever happened.
And also, Greg, as well, just to say, is the oftentimes as well, when you had those big long durations between retrospectives, the issues people were bringing to the table were the things that happened in the past 1 or 2 weeks during the release crunch, and never things that happened early
on
in the process.
And your memory is about the most recent stuff.
Yeah.
So that's exactly right, just like performance reviews, actually.
Yeah.
So we found that the retrospectives really didn't start to yield significant change until we had a small enough period where you could actually remember the whole period and have a small enough period to try new things in the next period. So that was our experience with the retrospectives, that they really didn't really do much good until we had small iterations. So the question to ask ourselves is, not are you doing retrospectives? The question to ask yourself is, are you regularly adjusting? Is the team adjusting their behavior based on them? And if they're not, which they weren't for us for quite some time, what do we have to do about that?
Mm-hmm. And it's not huge things either, is it? I mean, we do things like, we changed the order. Recently, we changed the order that we talk, because we're remote, everyone in stand-up has a time, has a particular slot that they go in, and you get to know, hey, I'm after, you know, I come after Murray and before Brian or something like that. You just know where you start to talk, and it makes that stand-up conversation happen a lot quicker because everybody knows when it's their turn to talk. So we one time in a retrospective, we realized because of the work we were working on, we'd previously been going down in alphabetical order as people appeared in Link, and that was as good an order as any to begin with. And then we realized that it actually meant we were switching and swatching across different topics because, you know, three of the team would be working on one particular area, three of the team would be working on this, and if those three people go together, then it actually makes the stand-up call run smoother. And that was just a small improvement that came out of a retrospective that we just, okay, let's change it. We changed the order, and from that day on, we did them differently. So it's little things like that, and, you know, change a work item, change a work item state, change, you know, those sorts of things. It's just small incremental improvements is the key, not big changes. Okay. So the next thing is, that's fine when you've got a team of, you know, any software project, I always say you can probably solve it with, give me 6 to 9 people, 6 to 9 months, and generally that's a software project, you know. I can deal with that. If the team starts getting so big that I can no longer fit it on a bus, then I know it's going to be painful. So somewhere between those two straw men is a ideal place where I like to have a software project. We work on a software project right now that has 3,500 people working on it, around about that. So scaling that software project when you've got 3,500 people all working in little, you know, say 10, 12 person teams can get a bit tricky. And so the key thing that we found there is to make sure that, as we say here, everybody's playing the same game. Everybody is working towards the same schedules. Everybody is obeying the same rules. And everybody's using the same standards to measure each other. Because you all know the problem that, you know, your team's brilliant, but the team next to you, they're okay. The team upstairs, they're a bit dumb. And the team in the office across the world, they're absolute idiots, you know? It always happens. There's an inverse stupidity curve. If the further away somebody sits from you in the org chart, then the more stupid they are. It's just how it works in all organizations. It's the same in Microsoft, unfortunately. And so the idea is to make sure that everybody in your wider team is playing the same game as you are, so that there's fairness and so you don't cheat. And so everybody is playing towards the same rules. And the key thing here is when to know, when to give teams the autonomy, because we all know having autonomy is the is one of the key drivers of success in creative endeavors, like software engineering is creative, and being allowed to do what you want to do and having control of your destiny is incredibly important for us as software craftspeople. It's when to give teams the autonomy, but when also to align them on specific things, specific goals, specific schedules. Mm-hmm. So, interestingly, in 2008, we started off and, you know, the iterations were kind of all over the place. All the different teams kind of worked really long iterations and we never really sunk up. And in fact, if you were, remember back in the 2005 days, who used, say, TFS 2005 or Visual Studio 2005? You remember during the early betas and you had to, like, install CTP 7 of this and beta 4 of that? And, oh, the dependencies between the two, between all the teams was quite phenomenal to work with from the outside. I was on the outside then. The similar thing happened in 2008. 2008 was actually really good release quality-wise, but a similar thing was happening in terms of the early betas and the synchronization of teams. In 2010, we really brought down our iteration length. But if you notice, the ALM team were, so the people who build, like, you know, Visual Studio Ultimate and those sorts of tools, they were working at a much shorter sprint schedule than the TFS team, who are on 6 weeks, and then the wider Visual Studio team working on longer schedules. And none of these schedules aligned either. So different teams would have different sprint boundaries. And we really found that shorter iterations were key. And shorter iterations are good because they make you break down work into more easy to manage chunks. So you know if you're on track or not, you know if you're done or not. But it also, aligning those sprint schedules also really helps, because we found that if you weren't on the same schedule as somebody else in the area, supposedly in your team, if they weren't working on the same schedule as you, it was a big psychological difference. They felt different to you. You know, they were asking you to do things when, no, I can't do that. We're coming to the end of a sprint. We need to, you know, we need to make sure we finish this stuff off. And you're asking me to fill out performance review forms? What's that about? You know, I'm busy right now. Go away. Come back next sprint and when they're busy. Also, because the sprint boundaries didn't align, initially we thought that would be a good thing because it would mean that we could, you know, we could pass dependencies to each other closer. Turns out it's really bad. And we actually, because you end up with cyclic dependencies, where you need this thing before this guy and he needs it before this guy over here, and because all the sprints are aligned, there's lots of waste. Everybody being on the same rhythm, marching to the same drum, really helped in terms of our productivity, and also as a big team of 3,500 people, making us feel like one team.
I would like to add to that. I think this is a time where we started giving teams autonomy. We let teams pick the length of their sprint and when they wanted to do this. We had some teams starting on a Wednesday and ending on a Tuesday. You know, they wanted to do not have the sprint end on a weekend. We had some teams start on a Monday, end on the Friday. And it was just a mess. And finally, we just had to say, enough. You don't get a choice. Everyone has to work on the same sprint schedule, and all sprints march to the same one. Our language is the same. And, you know, it's interesting. I've talked to a lot of customers who've been through this exact same thing. They start letting have autonomy with sprints. They all end up, it's too painful for everybody to have different sprint schedules. This is it. So it's like a decision to not give your teams, is what we learned.
Yeah.
Just make them, it's all aligned from the very start.
But there's sometimes where you might not, it's a sprint boundary that in North America falls over, say, the Thanksgiving break. Mm-hmm. And so you know that during that sprint boundary, my team, because they're based in North America, isn't going to deliver many features. So you plan that accordingly into your team's sprint schedule. So for my team, most of the developers are going to be away during Thanksgiving. Nearly the whole team is, apart from me sitting in Northern Ireland. But there you go, I'm European, so I get like 90 days off anyway, so it's great, you know, whatever. But I just take the rest of the year off. You know? So, but the The team are all not there, so we just schedule less work. And we communicate to the wider organisation, the work we've committed to for this sprint is this amount. Normally it would be this velocity, next time it's going to be this velocity. And that's because of we're just not going to deliver. Other teams would be, well, these are the sprint boundaries. The TFS team would push to production every sprint boundary as well. But the VSU team or the Visual Studio team might decide not to push a CTP of a particular, you know, Visual Studio update live into production because it doesn't make sense at the sprint boundary. They might take two or three or you know, eight or seven sprint boundaries where they actually decide to ship different releases. So you don't have to ship everything on the same schedule. You don't have to deliver the same velocity every schedule, but work to the same same drum.
Right.
Okay. Whoever's got a... Now, we all... We all tend to work in really big team projects, okay? That's how we work as well inside Microsoft. We have one team project that is DevDiv, and that contains 3,500 people working on Visual Studio, you know, TFS, Visual Studio Ultimate, everything. Mm-hmm. And they're all in this one... And then you've got the, you know, the people writing the MSDN documentation, the people doing the MSDN site, the people doing the forums. Everybody is in the same team project. So when we first started, we gave, again, autonomy over the area paths, that we allow people to create whatever area paths they need. And we had, you know, thousands of them. Yeah. And they quickly become unmanageable, even to the person on the team. It's like, what do we bucket things in now? So over time, we've found that we've been rapidly reducing the number of area paths. And these are the things that we actually say, hey, these are the high-level buckets that we stick work into. These belong to, and the area path controls kind of which sub-team owns this part of work. And that's how we kind of split out the work. And we use work item tagging quite a lot to then sub-categorize within our area path, sub-categorize that work down into our team. Before work item tagging came along, we used to use just, you know, strings inside the title of the work items and things like that. Mm-hmm. Is that how you work as well?
Yep, pretty much.
Okay. So again, that was an area where the area paths now, to get a new area path, I actually have to send an email to somebody and ask them for an area path. It's not somewhere where we give people autonomy over. On the transparent side, one of the classic quotes before I hand over to Greg. The reason I got excited about Team Foundation Server in particular and started work on TFS was... One of the analysts said, TFS gives, to software projects, gives the transparency of what was a bowling ball, gives it the transparency of a goldfish bowl. And so that's why I quite like this picture, because it's like people living in a goldfish bowl. But this is what it's all about. It's about being honest with yourself. So great.
Yeah, I agree. So I have a little story to tell about this to kind of make a point here. So the story is about an interaction I had with my son. So my son was a teenager, and... he would go out, and he went out with some friends one night. And then the next morning, I did my job as a dad, and I interrogated him, which is what I do every time he comes back. And I ask him what he was, where he was doing, who he was with, that kind of stuff. And, you know, he answers the questions. He said, I was with these friends and so forth. And then he said, well, there was one point where a bunch of the friends went off and started doing some drugs in the other room. And I freaked out. I'm like, what? You know, they actually did that? And he goes, yeah. And I'm like, oh, I don't know if you should be hanging out with these people or anything like that. And did they offer them to you? And he said, well, yes, they offered them to you? What's going on? And did you say no? Well, yes, Dad, I said no. And then I started thinking, like, okay, I don't think you should hang out with these people. And he said, listen, Dad, if you want me to tell you the truth, you're going to have to not freak out when I tell you. That was his point. And he was right. If I want to hear the truth, I can't freak out. And that's the same thing with transparency with teams. You know, everyone loves the transparency except for the people living in the glass house, right? They're the people who are doing tough things. And there's things that go on in teams. Performance problems, people make mistakes, people do things. And if we want transparency to go up, management has to be willing to listen to it and still trust the team to handle it, without just swooping in and trying to deal with it, right? Otherwise, you're going to shut transparency down. So that's one point we wanted to make with that, and that's what we found. The second thing we found, which is very interesting, was in the data. So we all had user stories. And teams used user stories to manage their backlog, as you would expect. So teams would have these user stories, and they would break them down, and they'd story point them. And each team would have their own story pointing system, and that's what they would do. What was happening, unbeknownst to the team, was that the user stories were being rolled up to management. And management was using them as, okay, this team has 15 user stories, this team has 20 user stories, and then all of a sudden there was this one team that had 120 user stories in their backlog. And they were like, what's going on? We need to figure this, obviously, we need to send someone to investigate what the problem is with that team. Well, what that team was doing was they were taking stories and they were breaking them down to very small, tiny stories because that's how they wanted to work. It worked best for them as a backlog. But what was happening was it was being rolled up to them, and people were expecting these nice, clean numbers that were consistent across teams, and they would burn down over time and so forth. And there was a problem there. And what we had to get to is we had to create a layer above user stories, which we call experiences, or a feature, or an epic. That layer above became the reporting mechanism going up. There was an understanding that this layer meant what management wanted to see, and user stories was all about the team. And when we got to that point, a lot of these transparency problems went away. But we needed to learn that there had to be a common language in the data, if you will. You have to understand how the data will be used in the transparency and communicate that to the teams so they can make sure it works.
Mm. And it was a very hard point to get to as well, because for a long time, there'd be unhealthy games that would get played between teams, mm-hmm. you know, about who could knock out the most stories in a sprint, or, you know, who's got the fewest bugs, and, you know, it was a game thing, and often, if people were being rewarded on stuff, then it would kind of affect how they behave. So we had to, the transparency of the house, it was a gradual making it more and more transparent, more letting teams see the inner workings of other teams. Mm-hmm. And that helped not just trust the other teams, but it also helped build up trust that, okay, everybody is as transparent as we are, therefore that's cool. You know, you don't just see... What I hate is when you see these emails that go out after a huge farce, something catastrophic that happened, mm-hmm. and it makes it sound like it was the best thing ever. You know, hey, great news! You know, we had 4 people go use this particular part of the service because the other 94 couldn't because it was down, broke, or something. Like, that's not great news, that's terrible news. You know, be honest when news is good and when news is bad. If you can't be honest to yourself in the team, then you can't trust anybody. If you can't be honest to yourself, you can't trust yourself. If you're not honest in the team, then you can't trust anybody. So honesty and is a big, comes side by side with the trust side.
I agree. All right. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So the last thing that we had to standardize on, we had to align on as team, is exit criteria. So this is the exit criteria from the 2008 release. You see, there's like 12 or 15 of them. We had to sign all of these off. So this was our user story work item, the equivalent of our user story work item. We had to sign all of these off before we could check in the code. And there was elaborate reporting mechanisms across all the features to make sure, you know, see where people were with their criteria. And this fit very much with the command and control model that Martin was referring to. But what we found is if you have several dozen teams shipping every 3 weeks directly to production, this doesn't scale. It doesn't work anymore. So what we ended up doing in a situation like this, where we're shipping every 3 weeks, is first of all, we really pared down the number of exit criteria that we have. And the exit criteria that we have are no performance regressions. It must be globalizable, localizable, accessible, because we have accessibility requirements like keyboard only and so forth, and colorblind testing. There's security. That's very, very important all throughout Microsoft. Everything goes through a security review to make sure that we don't have security holes. And then there's a set of automated test runs that must remain passing. However, we trust the teams to take care of this. So we are assuming that when teams check in, that they are not violating any of these exit criteria. At the same time, in the main branch, we're consistently running these tests all the time on the main branch. And if there's an exception, like a performance test has regressed or test runs are failing, then we follow the exception back to the team and then have a discussion at that point. And that is what we found that scales. And you know what else we found? Most of the time, it works. Most of the time, when you trust the teams, if they understand this is what's going to happen, the teams step up to the challenge, and it works. No one would have trusted the teams to do this in the 2008 release, in the old command and control model.
And it used to happen as well, didn't it? The accessibility and the localization work, that would all happen like after beta 2 or something. It would like, you know, let's slam the features in, let's get them in. And then now let's make it work so everybody can actually use them, sort of thing. It was very the tenant work, we call it, the less interesting work to some people is done at the very end, and you know, let's get the features in there first. And it completely changed where it's being done the whole time. And this is one of the things, because I came to Microsoft from outside of the company. My company was acquired by Microsoft in 2009. That's where I started. And this is one of the things where I found that Microsoft had come closer to how I was working in the past, where I was, you know, we were trying to keep a consistent CI build quality up there. We consistently having builds that were good to run all the time. And when I first started looking at Microsoft, it was like, wow, this doesn't happen at all. And then Microsoft have come closer to how we were working, which was interesting. Mm-hmm. And one of the data points, as quickly as there as well, Greg, is in the 2005 release around the quality and the integration and the non-functional requirements, you can think of them. In 2005, I think throughout the whole 2005 cycle, up until like the late RCs, I think we had two of three. So we qualify builds as self-host, meaning they're good to run, or self-toast. They will kill your machine, you know. Mm-hmm. So we had three or four builds during the 2005 release that were self-hostable, mm-hmm. like three or four in the months, in the, you know, years that 2005 was being developed. That was terrible, awful. And in 2010, I think we had like three or four that were self-toast, you know, it was like, and red bang emails went out like, red alert, don't install this build. And I've seen one in the 2013 mm-hmm. lifecycle don't install this build, there's a really bad bug in setup that will mess your machine up and you'll have to re-image your machine type of thing. So, it's made a huge difference. And that's one of those healthy habits to get into, because not only are you keeping on top of the things which people don't find fun, you're making sure everyone stays on top of them, but you're making sure your product is of a consistent quality so that on these iteration boundaries where we ship an update or we ship a major release, we can basically just cut it from the main branch and there isn't a huge amount of work that needs to get done on that. It's always ready to ship. It's potentially shippable. That's one of the great phrases of Scrum and Agile. Mm-hmm.
So the question to ask yourself is, are the teams playing the same game that you are? Are they playing the same game as each other? Is there a set of ground rules that's common to all your teams so you all have a common language that you're speaking with each other? That's the question that we had to ask ourselves.
Yes. And if not, how do you make them work that way?
That's right.
As well.
All right, let's talk about debt, what we learned about debt. So let's talk about what debt is. Debt, first of all, is something that you owe. You have to, in real life, you owe it. Pretending the debt is not there doesn't make the debt go away. The other thing about debt is there's interest, which means the longer you take to pay off the debt, the more it's going to cost to pay it down. Those two principles apply to software as well, that pretending you don't have debt doesn't make it go away, and taking longer to pay it off, it's going to take more effort to pay it down. That's just how it is.
And it's also about making sure everyone has the same levels of debt as well. You're not trying to, you know, one team doesn't have more debt than you do and things like that.
Exactly. I'm going to talk about four different types of debt here, and let me flip through them now. The first is bug debt. I want to talk a little bit about my feeling about how bugs work. I'm not saying this is scientific. I'm just telling this is based on my watching teams and how it works. So I believe that when a team develops, when you develop a feature, you know, the act of adding a new feature introduces bugs. It's just a factor of the bigger the feature, the more bugs that you have. And there's a bug tail to a feature. Now, if you're in a healthy, agile team, you are finding and fixing most of those bugs during development and shortly after. So your bug tail is quite short. But there still is a tail in that you will find bugs in that feature one sprint, two sprints, several sprints later. That's just, it's a very skinny, it's exponential, but there is a tail. And the healthy team always understands that if they're going to stay on top, if they're going to deal with their bug debt, they need to reserve time to always be dealing with the bugs that come off from previous bug tails that overlap. And you can kind of see how I have the bug tail overlapping the feature time, sort of communicate like we're going to do less features to make sure that we keep our bugs down. So that's kind of what that is about. Now, if you're an unhealthy team, maybe your bug tail looks more like this, where you know you generate a bunch of code, a pile of code. There's tons of bugs. It takes a long time to get those bugs taken care of. And you know, if you waited to get your bugs under control to work on the next feature, well, that would look like that. Well, that's no fun. So let's do this instead, right? So yeah, let's just have all this fun generating all these features, and we build up this big pile of debt. And kind of, you know, how it looks like a whale about to eat somebody. But that's like you get this big pile of debt that you just leave there. And you know what? When you're in that feature phase, it's very easy to just say, forget, I forgot. I'm not even pretending I have debt. But it's there, and you have to pay it. And the longer it stays there, the more expensive it's going to be to pay off. This is how we worked. In 2008, 2010, that's exactly how we worked. And we dealt with these long, expensive stabilization periods that we'll talk about a little bit later in the slide deck as well. So we learned that the healthy teams dealt with their bugs right away. So how did we deal with it? This is how we dealt with it. We came up with this idea of a bug cap. So I'll explain it. Let's say you have a team of 10 engineers on your team. We would give you 3 bugs per engineer. So if you were a team of 10 people, you could have 30 open bugs on your team. And if you exceed 30 bugs, you've exceeded your bug cap. And the expectation is you stop your feature work and you bring your bugs back down again. And that was the rule across the entire org is that based on the size of your team, you got set a bug cap, and if you went above it, you had to stop. Now, of course, there were exceptions. We didn't do it all the time where we made people stop. We didn't follow this rule. But in general, we use this to try to keep the bugs down. If things, right now, I think every day we're getting an email of all the teams that are over their bug cap.
Well, so all the teams get the email.
All the teams get the email, right. All the teams get the email highlighting the teams that are over your bug cap, right? So people pay attention to it. And now what we find is the healthier teams. So you're going to have teams that are not so healthy. They're always bumping against that bug cap all the time. But the healthier teams look more like this, right? The bug cap is irrelevant to them. They're so on top of their bugs. They're so good at keeping that bug tail short and making this as skinny as possible that they can knock off those bugs as quickly as possible. And that's what you would like to get to. But you can't assume every team's going to be there. So the bug cap is what the ground rules are for everybody.
And you've got to make sure you're not getting to this by having test debt.
That's correct. That's right. You don't want to have another debt.
Yeah.
And I talked to a thing to add to this. I talked to a friend of mine who worked with a company. They actually they started with a bug cap very high, and then every sprint they slowly brought it down at a stair-step level to slowly bring it to the sustainable level. And that's how they got their bugs under control from, nearly 1,000 bugs to a very small number of bugs. He said it took 18 months to do it, but they were able to slowly get their bugs under control. Another one's technical debt. And I'm going to talk about a specific one that I think is very common, what we see in our orgs, and that's unit test debt. That is generating a bunch of code without any kind of unit tests. I would describe this kind of debt as like a trapeze artist performing without a safety net. You know, you can see these trapeze artists and they're doing these amazing things, and the reason they're willing to do those amazing things is because they know they have that net that will catch them if they fall. And if you look at healthy teams, They have this nice safety net of unit tests. And they're willing to do refactoring. They're willing to add features late into the cycle. They're willing to be bold and take risks. But they have this safety net. And if they don't have a net, or they have a net with a lot of holes in it, they're going to be much more risk averse, much less willing to do this. So the interesting thing is, talking to tons of devs, almost all of them want to write unit tests. They do. They understand why it's important. They understand how it improves their life. But guess what the number one reason why they don't? Anybody want to guess? Schedule pressure is the number one reason. They don't do it because they're told to go work on the next feature. We have to do this. We have to work on the next feature. I can't tell a customer that we have great unit tests. And I think that's a tragedy, because that's like forcing a trapeze artist to continue to perform without their safety net. And asking them to enhance their routine and make it better and all this kind of stuff, it's really unfair to the team to do that. And so we've seen some teams do really good at this, and some teams not so good. And the teams that do good are the ones that are willing to take these bold chances and actually deliver more functionality in the long run, because they can. They're safe. Feature debt. Feature debt is what I would call that piece of functionality that without it, the feature you delivered is useless. It's kind of like a car without tires. You know, the team could have developed the most amazing motor or the most sexy looking dashboard, but if there's no tires on that car, it's pretty useless. An example we had was people were developing all these features, but they weren't updating the setup scripts or the install scripts. But everyone was saying we're done, right? So in our process, like, you have to make these changes to get it to work. The customer can't use it. There's nothing the customer can do with this thing unless they can actually install it and get it on their machine. So it's debt. You can claim some victory over this, but you still have to do that setup and install stuff. Another example are features that, unless the customer has them, they can't use it. So I'm going to be honest with you and talk about this. Tags. Tags is something we've added recently. How many have heard about tags that we've put added? Okay. We've added this kind of lightweight tagging to the work item tracking thing. But you know what? The one thing everyone needs is the ability to query on those tags. We don't have that yet. A lot of people aren't able to use the feature until they can query on it. I would call that feature debt as well. I have to pay that off for people. Otherwise, the feature, it's like I never built it. For some people. And then the last one I'll call done debt. And this is really getting to the exit criteria again, is that we had a time where, like Martin said, we saved all this stuff till the end in the stabilization phase. So not in addition to all those big bugs that we were working on, that big whale-shaped looking bugs, we're also doing all our performance testing for the first time, all our localization testing for the first time, all of this stuff. And it really, it just caused a stabilization, we'll talk about it more, but the stabilization phase, I tell you, is death to the team's morale. It kills them. And I think, really, what's the most important factor to a team's morale? Let them ship something. Like, you don't have to have fancy parties. Let them ship something meaningful, and they're happy. That's where they're at. But if you're not, they're not shipping if they're building up all this debt. So the question we had to ask ourselves is, how much debt are we really carrying? And take a hard look at it, and what do we have to do to deal with it every single sprint?
And trying to really identify, isn't it, that debt yourself. You know, like the technical debt, it's you're experiencing a problem frequently. Like, we were experiencing problems with logging in from Eclipse to the service, and we're experiencing a problem. And we experience it two or three times, and we're like, hang on a minute, why is this coming up more than once? And it turned out it was because we had, there was some technical debt. There was a missing level of testing that we weren't doing there before we shipped a release that we needed to do. So we go and fix that. So finding that debt yourself isn't just about making sure people aren't. Nobody deliberately hides debt. That's not what they're trying to do, or very rarely. It's mostly about debt you've got to think about and actually consciously go look for. Mm-hmm. So next thing we wanted to bear in mind is to always remember that you get what you measure. I'm a physicist. I did physics at school. And there's in physics, there's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which in layman's terms basically means any measurement you take on a system affects the system at measure. So whatever you do as a measurement affects that you're trying to measure. And this is, you see this all the time in the normal world, you know, in the land of muggles where the real people live. In the UK, we've got some problems at the minute with the finding issues with our healthcare system. And a lot of this seems to be driven from the very measurement-orientated system that's in place there. It's making sure they're hitting certain targets, certain key deadlines, rather than looking at the whole care package. In education, every new, you know, it's like when marketing teams come into engineering, you know, the first thing they do is change the logo and change the name a little bit. In education, when a new government comes in, the first thing they do is try and shake up the education system and try and shake up the healthcare system a bit, because it makes them feel like they're doing something. And so how they do that is by putting yet another measurement on the education system or the healthcare system or the road service or whatever. And so education suffers from this as well, where children are being, you know, more and more encouraged to hit certain exam targets because that's how teachers are being measured. And that actually ends up in, you know, adjusting the actual kind of education that those children are receiving. My favorite example comes from, not from software at all, but actually, again, it's another story from the UK. In the UK, we deregulated our directory inquiries. So, I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember this, but back in the day when we used to use telephones to call people, you used to have to ring a number to figure out a phone number, directory inquiries. Yeah, you didn't use Bing or Google or whatever. You had to actually ring a number and ask for a phone number. So we deregulated our directory lookup service in the UK. And now we had different companies able to compete for the directory lookup business. And, you know, they all begin with 118, and then you can dial another number. And there were lots of different tactics to be the new dominant player for this new, you know, directory lookup service. There was branding, marketing, and also, you know, quality of service. One company decided, right, we're going to this new business. What we need to do is we need to incentivize our agents. So let's get lots of calls through because we want to maximize our profit. So they incentivized their agents based on the number of phone calls that they handled in a day. That seems perfectly sensible. You're a call center. Of course you're going to incentivize your agents on the number of calls they handle a day. Just like, of course, it makes sense. We're developers. We should be incentivized on the number of lines of code we add a day. That makes sense, doesn't it? And you'll find out, similarly to tracking people by lines of code, which is the craziest measurement ever, tracking call center staff on this directory inquiries by the number of calls they handled was totally the wrong thing. Because what they were finding is that people would ring up, say, hello, who do you want to speak to? I would like to speak to. And before they'd even got the answer, bang, just send them to a number. You know, I don't care. Bang, get you off my phone so I can get the next person. And so the quality of the results that those agents were giving back to the end customers was terrible. And so people never dialed that particular 118 service again. And so while it maximized their short-term profit, the company wasn't around very long. And so this is it. By taking a measurement of a system and a single-dimensional measurement, you completely affect it. So you have to be careful not just what you measure. You have to be very, very careful about that measurement that you're taking and think through the impact it will have on the system. And if you start to see negative effects, one answer might be to add another measurement into the system. Another answer might actually be to just remove the measurement altogether and look at something else. And that's often a better thing to do, is to just take that measurement away. And then, because it gives people the creativity to be able to, you know, to be able to do what they want. Lines of code is a great example. If I go into work and I remove 2,000 lines of code yet deliver a feature, that was a fantastic day. That was the best day ever. I've delivered a feature and there's less code to maintain. Yet if I'm incentivized on adding lines of code, I'm going to do that. If I incentivize my developers on stories that they personally complete, not the team, but the developer personally completes, I'm going to get the senior devs not talking to the junior devs, because the senior devs are busy trying to complete as many stories as they possibly can. and letting the junior devs never learn from them because they're incentivized to produce their stories. So be very careful about the measurements. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in the old days, what we used to do is we would have this big construction phase, you know, build for a year, yay, we're done, and then we'd have stabilization. And this was actually in the plan, a year of this and a year of stabilization. I came to Microsoft and I was like, what the heck? And I would actually come, and we'd get to the end of the construction phase in the team I'd be in, and I'd be like, yay, we're done. And then they say, right, now we stabilize for a year. I'm like, what? I don't understand. I'm done. No. Now is when you fix bugs. Now when you do globalization. Now when you do... No. I did all that because I'm done. That's what I mean by done. Whereas another team might not have had that experience. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, what I had. So I was... So this is the thing. We had this in our plan. And it was... And we were in the construction phase. And we were trying to be agile. We were trying to burn down our debt on the team that we were on. And what we were doing is we were going to start a new sprint, and rather than start on features, we were going to burn down the bugs, right? Well, someone from management heard about that and came and talked to us and said, look, you have a year to fix bugs later. Now's the time to do features. You can't do features later. It would be irresponsible of you to fix your bugs now. That was a discussion. And my initial reaction was, that's stupid. And then I got a performance review that I need to be a little nicer. That's what happened to me. But that was what happened. And you know what? That person was probably right. If this is the plan, then maybe it is irresponsible to fix bugs in the construction phase, maybe. But my point is, the fact that stabilization phase was there changed the behavior of people in the construction phase. They gamed the system, is what they did.
Our team, because we didn't game the system, we got to the end of the construction phase, and now we'd done the features that we care about. You know, we'd made all the painful cuts. We weren't happy with everything, because you never are. You know, there's always more you want to do. And now we're in this big stabilization phase. We've got no bugs. So our team gets disbanded and we go fix everybody else's bugs. Yep. And how's that a reward for staying on top of your debt, you know? So you've got to be very careful.
And I remember having a talk with a senior manager about this, and I said, look, having that stabilization phase is causing bad behavior. And his answer was, I don't know another way to take a team of 1,000 people and get them ready for ship. Like, I don't know of any other way. And that's what we found, is that there are very smart people, very senior people who were very successful shipping in this old way, and they know how to make it work. And when you move to an organization where you take away this sort of safety buffer, right, then it's hard for them to understand. Like, how am I going to get a team of 1,000 people or 3,000 people to shut down? And really what we had to get to the point was we had to remove the stabilization phase. We had to. And when we started shipping to the hosted service every 3 weeks, it was gone. We were shipping at the end. There was no stabilization phase anymore that anyone could count on. And that is when behavior started to change. Now, in the meantime, we did have kind of a transition period where they actually would say, look, if you get to the stabilization phase and you have no bugs, we promise we will not make you work on other people's bugs. We won't do what we did to Martin's team. You'll get to continue to work on features. You'll have to get approval, but you'll continue to work on features. And that was during the transition phase, and that started to help change some behavior. Not all the teams, though. Many teams still just relied on it to fix bugs later. So it's kind of how that worked.
And it takes, I mean, to turn around an organization that size as well, it takes a long time for behaviors to change. And it starts from the top in how they're influenced. But, like I said, we had to do it in a way that it wasn't a big bang. The whole team is going to work differently tomorrow. Mm-hmm. We had to invent ways that we could gradually transition the team into working this new way.
So this is, you know, that big whale I drew of a big pile of bugs? This is the actual data of the pile of bugs that was at the end of 2005. And yes, that number is in the 20,000s. That's for the entire Visual Studio organization. Here's another example of what happens when you focus on a single metric. We in Microsoft, we have this thing called ZBB. Does anyone know what ZBB means? How many people have even known? I had no idea what this meant when I first came to Microsoft. It stands for Zero Bug Bounce. And what it is that a date is set, and you can see there the date was April 23, 2004. The date is set, and the mandate was made, every team will be at zero bugs on that day. And so every team creates these step-down goals, and every month we'll be down more bugs and more bugs. And you'll see how we are basically burning down our bugs. But I want to point out that little purple line. That purple line is the number of active bugs. So what people were doing was just moving them to the next release. If they're just measuring on burning down your bugs for the 2005 release, we're just going to move them to the 2008 release, and we meet our goal. And that's exactly what was happening. And really what we had to do is get to the point of, we can't have this debt anymore. We have to measure on, that's when we started to move to a bug cap kind of thing and saying, look, this is the new metric, not the ZBB so much. We still have ZBBs. They're part of Microsoft culture that I don't know if will ever change, but the ZBBs are a lot less monumental than what you're seeing here.
It's now just a deadline, really.
Yeah, that's right. So during the construction phase, we measured on how many features you'd produced. That's what you got. You got that many features produced. And on the stabilization phase, we focused on bugs. Well, that's what you got. You got bugs that were a nice burn down chart because people were moving down. If you focus on a single metric, it's going to cause problems. So what do we measure now? Now, that might be a question. Okay, Greg, Martin, what are you guys doing now? Well, our measurements are essentially two things plus the exit criteria. We measure the number of features completed, and we measure how you're doing on your bug cap. So essentially, functionality and quality. And then, as I said, the exit criteria are consistently being tested all the time. There's performance runs being run all the time on the main branch. If you have performance regressions, they're logged as bugs, and they count towards your bug cap. If you've regressed five performance scenarios, you get five bugs counting towards your bug cap. If you have three localization errors, they go towards your bug cap. If you have some security problems that the security champion reviewed and found, it gets logged as a bug. So that way, all these things feed into the bug cap. The bug cap is controlled by the number of people you have on your team, and that's how we end up measuring. That's where we're at. Now, I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm not saying in 2 years, if we're giving this talk again, we might be saying something different. But these seem to be working pretty well for us right now.
One thing that's important as well is we wouldn't say reward Greg's team because he had 10 features and my team only had four or something like that. Because otherwise you start people playing games where, you know, one man's feature is another man's bug and people just move things around. It's about, you know, you're all measured on actually what's getting out the door and end user productivity and end user functionality, not on single metrics.
And really, if you notice, there's this common theme of exit criteria, the definition of done. It really comes down to that. Like, the definition of done is what defines what the common playing rules are. It defines what debt is and is not. It defines what things you should measure on. And really, we just found, like, you have to determine what is done. And when you determine what is done and start holding people accountable to it, that's when we saw change. And we also saw change when done wasn't a 16 checkpoint list, right? It had to be a manageable list of things for people to deal with. So, the question we had to ask ourselves is, what are we measuring? And what does that measurement produce? And is it producing the right behavior? And if it's not, which it wasn't for us, what kind of changes did we have to make? We want to end this on more of a people note, if you will, and that's about trust. And what we found is leadership had to get to the point where they trusted the team to deliver production quality software. In the old command and control model, it was almost built on a paradigm of distrust. If you consider the stabilization phase, it really is engineered for the worst performing team. It's taking like the worst performing team in your organization. How long will it take for that team to get ready to ship? And then you make all the teams work that way. That's really what it was like. And we had to get to the point where we had to say, look, we trust you to ship production quality software. and we're going to assume that you can. Here's the other thing. Just as important, the team have to learn to trust themselves to ship production quality software. They have no stabilization phase to catch them anymore. They are the last line of defense before we ship to production, since we ship every 3 weeks to production. There is no review board that's going to verify all the fixes. The exit criteria, it's up to them. And the team had to get to the point where they trusted themselves. And I'll tell you a story. About 3 sprints after we started shipping every sprint to the hosted service, so we had done like 1 release, 2 release, and we were on our 3rd release, someone checked in some code that basically brought, we have this whole phase where we put it on a pre-production server and we test it for a while, you know, like 3 days just to verify it's okay before we push it. It brought the whole thing down. It destabilized the whole code base, and there was a lot of rushing around, and in the end, we couldn't ship that sprint. Now, the initial reaction was, well, you know, we used to ship every 2 years. Now, you know, we skipped a sprint. Okay, we'll ship again in 3 weeks. It's not that big a deal. But this is a situation where I think management acted exactly right. They said, this is unacceptable. Not only did that one team not get their features shipped, but all these other dozens of teams, because they all go through the same ship train, didn't get their stuff shipped either. We cannot have this. If that team wasn't ready, they should have never checked in their code in the first place. And then there was a lot of heat put on that team to find out exactly what they did wrong. They had to report up again to say, look, this is what we did wrong, this is what we're going to do, and it was fine. It wasn't like that team was getting punished. Like, I'm not trying to communicate that. What I am trying to communicate is that there was a standard that was set in place and communicated. And since then, the number of times we've botched it, it isn't zero, but it has been a whole lot less. And I think it has a lot to do with that expectation. And teams, I could feel it. Like, I could feel it. All the teams sort of, like, kind of got on guard and stepped up their game a little bit because they knew that they were going to get heat if they broke the release. So that was an important thing.
And not being punished, it's all about peer pressure, isn't it? They just don't want to be you don't want to be the one that lets the side down. You don't want to be the team whose features stopped everybody else's stuff getting out there. So it's not a punishment thing at all. And in fact, that's one of the things I really like about our organization is that, you know, bugs happen and things happen, and there isn't a blame culture at all. There's a complete, you know, absence of blame culture. It's about how do we stop that from happening in the future, you know, if it's, or occasionally it is we're taking risks, so, you know, okay, well, mm-hmm. let's how can we adjust that without overreacting too much?
Yep, I would agree. I want to pile on that and say, you know, the transparency, this kind of trust, it works because the leadership in the organization that we're in the ALM organization, is very, very good about listening to bad news and not freaking out. They know that it's a problem. They know that this stuff just happens. What they hate is when they don't know. Mm-hmm. And so they know that, hey, eventually we were going to botch a release. That's not the problem. The problem is that if we don't learn from it and we just kind of brush it off, that was the real issue. It wasn't about punishing anybody.
Yeah, so. And you wouldn't get fired for making that really bad mistake. You'd get fired for trying to hide that really bad mistake.
Yeah. So would you trust your teams to ship? Or maybe would you trust every one of your teams to ship? That's the question that we had to ask ourselves. So that's the end. That's the summary. We talked about, you know, retrospective tuning, setting the game rules, controlling debt, measuring based on output, and trust. And this is really a part of our journey. And we don't claim to stand here and say we have all the answers. We don't. There are certainly lots of things I feel like we're still doing wrong. If any of you tried to install update 1 of the 2012 release, you probably understand. We did some things wrong, and we're trying to learn. So please don't take it that we think we know everything, but we just wanted to share some of the things we did learn. And that's it. So I think now...
Couple of things, questions. If people, this is how to get hold of me and Greg. Mm-hmm. I'll be at if you go down to the expo hall, I'll be at the ALM booth, one of the purple ones, there for the between 6 and 8:30 tonight, and I'll be there most of the week as well. So feel free to come down, ask questions, and talk. If you can please do evals, I would ask you, there's a QR code, I'll put it up in a second as well. If we don't get more than 10 evals, then we don't get to come back, basically. So please fill out your eval. And then some sessions for you. Hopefully, obviously, most of you went to the foundational session this morning from Brian Keller, who's always excellent. David Starr is going to be talking later on this evening about some of the features, if you saw in the keynote, around Code Lens and some of the features we've done there in CodeMap and improving the experience inside Visual Studio. David's going to be talking about those tonight at 5 to 6:15. And then straight out from that session, you can come down and get some free beer in the expo hall. So there's a reason to stay for that session. And if you want to come speak to me, bring me a Diet Coke or something, and I'll definitely talk to you. Okay. On Wednesday, a couple of sessions that are worth going to. Greg's going to be talking about the Agile Planning Tools first thing in the morning, so an encouragement not to drink too many of those free beers.
Please.
And then at lunchtime, I'll be talking about the changes we've made to introduce Git and distributed version control into the Team Foundation service and into Visual Studio. And then Thursday, we're going to be talking about cloud load testing and the test management stuff. And then on Friday, I'm going to be talking about ALM as a service. Okay. Thank you very much for your time, or extra resources. And I'll put up the slide. And if anybody's got any questions, then please raise your hand, and we'll shout them out
for you. Any questions at all?
Okay. Oh, thank you.
Okay. Thank you.